From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Burock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. The month of July has proven to be a deadly time for migrants attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border illegally. Today, we'll report on the number of illegal immigrants who've died in the southern Arizona desert so far this year, how the numbers have increased over the years, and how the Pima County Medical Examiner's Office has handled this increase in bodies. A group called GrassFire.org has put up a billboard on Tucson's south side. It reads, "Stop the invasion, secure our borders." Christopher Conover will report on why the group is displaying the billboard. He'll also have some local reaction to it. We'll speak with Pam Reed, director of the Tucson Marathon, who's preparing to run the Badwater Ultra Marathon on Monday. She's won twice so far. And Su Yun Lee takes us inside the local Chinese Cultural Center. Those stories and more coming up, but first. The Sonoran Desert is the hottest of the North American deserts. Temperatures along the Arizona-Mexico border consistently rise above 110 degrees, sometimes reaching as high as 120 this time of year, making it the harshest stretch of the U.S.-Mexico border. And for those trying to get into the country illegally, it's the deadliest. As border crossers make their trek along the southern Arizona desert, they're put at risk not only by the fierce heat, but by the desert plant life and venomous reptiles that live there. But oftentimes they're not prepared for the treacherous journey and underestimate the harsh conditions they'll encounter. Heat stroke is described as a potentially fatal disorder that results from extreme elevations of body temperatures. Heat deaths in Pima County are rare, except among illegal border crossers. For years, groups like No More Deaths and Derechos Humanos have patrolled the desert, offering aid to migrants in distress, and the U.S. Border Patrol conducts emergency rescues in the desert every day. But migrants continue to die horrifying, violent deaths with no relief on the horizon.
The initial symptoms are headache, feeling hot, feeling thirsty. After that, it progresses to confusion, muscle weakness, and usually death if you're without water and shade for a couple days at a time.
Dr. Samuel Keim is associate professor in the University of Arizona Department of Emergency Medicine. He recently published the first scientific journal article to investigate the public health issue of heat-related deaths among immigrants crossing into Arizona. It appeared in the April issue of the Journal of Immigrant and Minority Health. He examined the heat-related deaths recorded by the Pima County Medical Examiner between 1998 and 2003.
We have witnessed an increase in the total number of heat-related deaths in southern Arizona. What we did attempt to do was to compare those deaths to the number of Border Patrol apprehensions, which is a somewhat controversial but standard way of looking at what the volume of border crossers is in southern Arizona. And if you look at the number of deaths compared to the Border Patrol apprehensions, at least for the years since 1999, the rate of heat deaths appears to be increasing, because while we have an absolute increase in the number of heat deaths, the number of Border Patrol apprehensions during that same period actually decreased.
Dr. Keim says the most dramatic increase was from 2001 to 2002, in which the number of documented heat-related deaths in Pima County nearly doubled from 50 to 99. Representing a 98% increase from the previous year. And the majority of the cases were people of non-U.S. origin whose bodies were discovered in remote wilderness areas. This indicates they were more likely than not illegal border crossers.
I think what it means is that the people who are crossing in riskier situations. They're either crossing in more remote desert regions, or they're putting themselves at greater risk. The activity of crossing the border is covert. They're trying to hide, they're trying to evade escape, and that puts them at greater risk for heat death.
Outside the Pima County Medical Examiner's office near the former Keno Hospital on Ajo Way, a refrigerated truck hums in the mid-July heat. And nearby, construction of a permanent refrigeration building is underway. It's to hold the overflow of bodies currently being stored at the county morgue. Inside, Dr. Bruce Parks, chief medical examiner, meets with a grieving family who has come to identify the remains of a man who was recently found in the desert, something that doesn't happen very often.
Certainly less than 10% of the time where that happens. They're typically an indigent migrant family from rural Mexico, and they don't have resources to come here and look at the person, but the Mexican consulate will use their resources to have families look at photographs of the person and personal effects and whatnot to make the identification, or we can do it through fingerprints and other means.
Over the last 6 years, the bodies of over 800 border crossers have been brought to this office, straining staff and draining financial resources. Dr. Park says border crossers have altered the way they work on many fronts.
Over the past several years, this office has seen more of these individuals than any place in the country, I would imagine. I haven't seen anything to refute that. It was not the case a while ago. In the mid to late 90s, it was not even a blip on the radar as far as the border crossers dying. There weren't that many. Then come 2000, when we started to see an increase, and it's steadily gone up ever since. And now, last year we had close to 200 border crossers that died, and when we're doing about 1,400 autopsies a year, 200 out of 14 is a fairly high percentage.
In addition to the amount of time it takes to conduct the autopsies, there's a great amount of time that goes into trying to identify the border crossers. And oftentimes, they remain at the morgue for a long period of time, while the county works with a Mexican consulate to make the identification.
If they're not identified, they remain here typically longer than, of course, if they are identified, because we're trying to identify them, and that takes time. And people actually can remain here for more than a year, even in some cases a couple of years, if we have leads that we're still trying to track down. If the person's identified early on, then they may only be here a day or two.
The medical examiner's office performs autopsy 7 days a week, about four a day to keep up, and they've had to add staff to work more efficiently. Recently, the medical examiner's office budget was increased by $160,000 to help with the increased caseloads, including $125,000 to hire a fifth forensic pathologist, a job that is in short supply these days. But even though they feel overwhelmed at times, Dr. Park says the office is not in dire straits. So far this year, the numbers are lower than this time last year. July of 2005 was the deadliest month ever for border crossers, with 69 being brought to the morgue. So far this year, Dr. Parks has confirmed that 111 have perished from the heat. That's compared to 123 at the same time last year. But he admits that when he has to work on a weekend and hears a weather forecast calling for extreme temperatures, he braces himself for an influx.
I don't usually do this, but I thought, wow, they predict 110 today. And, of course, when the temperature goes up, the number of people that die often goes up as well. And so I'm somewhat bracing myself for maybe a heavier influx of border crossers who have passed away this weekend. But we'll see. It doesn't always work out that way, and hopefully it won't.
Next week on Arizona Spotlight, we'll follow a local Tucson group across the border as they provide aid to migrants after they've been apprehended and deported to Nogales, Mexico. Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight when we continue. Christopher Conover reports on an anti-illegal immigration billboard that's been erected on Tucson's south side. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. A self-described conservative family rights group out of Iowa has debuted an anti-illegal immigration billboard in South Tucson. Christopher Conover reports.
Drivers heading west on I-10 near South 6th Avenue are getting an eyeful of the immigration debate with the debut of the new grassfire.org billboard with the message, "Stop the invasion, secure our borders."
The words in that billboard now represent the sentiment of literally millions of citizens across this country.
Steve Elliott is the president of the Iowa-based grassfire.org. The billboard in Tucson is the 12th in the country, with others being erected in cities including Dallas, Atlanta, Miami, San Diego, and Phoenix. Elliott says the wording was carefully picked.
This truly amounts to an invasion of our country. Now, it's an invasion in two basic ways. It's an invasion in fact, and it's an invasion in principle. In fact, we have 12 to 20 million people who are now in our country illegally. That's our best estimates. We really don't know how many people are here illegally because they are undocumented workers, of course, many of them. So we don't know exactly what that number is. It's also an invasion in principle because, unfortunately, in our country today, we have very strong forces on the left and on the right, on this side of the border and on that side of the border, that want to minimize, reduce, maybe even eliminate our borders.
But the invasion argument isn't washing with border activists like the Reverend Robin Hoover with Humane Borders.
Well, we have a lot of evangelists of fear, and they've been doing this for a long time, one form or another. I've recently discovered a historical citation that the first reference to the concept of an invasion coming from Mexico, sponsored by their government, facilitated by the migration of so many people to come up here to get jobs, was offered in the 1920s. So we've seen this. It's the same song, a different verse. What causes us to reel is to see this in a large billboard where so many people will see it. Maybe it's more effective thesis today.
Hoover calls the idea behind the billboard a hateful message.
It's not blatant racism, so now they're pointing to some sort of cultural imperialism as being, or that's what I'm calling what they're doing. They're cultural imperialists that think that we're better than everybody else. No other culture is any good, and if people are here from someplace else, then they have to be bad people. What's the real Achilles heel in what they're doing is one half, it's actually about 43%, but nearly one half of the people who are here undocumented in the United States are people who overstayed their visas, and they came here legally by other means. And there's a tremendous number of people in our country who are here legally working who are also from some other culture, et cetera. So what's the invasion portion? Where does that come from? It can only come from people that think that they're better than somebody else. And that's a kind of politics that we don't want to see in this country.
Tucson residents are not strangers to the immigration debate, and that is why grassfire.org's Steve Elliott says his local supporters wanted the billboard put up here.
We found every place we've put a billboard. It has had a very strong impact on doing some things. First of all, encouraging those who are already taking a stand. It's a great encouragement to know that there's people across the country who are also standing with you. And also, there are still more Americans who have not engaged in this debate in a real way by expressing their opinion, by voicing their opinion, by calling their elected officials, by taking a stand, by not hiring an illegal to mow their lawn. Let's make this very specific. Or to roof their house. These are the practical stands that we need to start to take as citizens of this country to take back our nation.
When asked, backers wouldn't divulge the exact cost of putting the billboard up for a month in Tucson. But they do say all the money for it was raised locally, and the cost of the project nationally is more than $150,000 at this point. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, an interview with Pam Reed, the director of the Tucson Marathon. She's going for a third win at the Badwater Ultra Marathon on Monday. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. The Badwater Ultramarathon is arguably the world's toughest running event. It covers 135 miles from Death Valley to Mount Whitney, California, in temperatures that can top 120 degrees. Pam Reed has won the ultramarathon twice, once in 2002 and again in 2003, and she's going for a third win on Monday. Pam Reed is also the director of the Tucson Marathon, and she's written a book entitled The Extra Mile, One Woman's Personal Journey to Ultra-Running Greatness. She joins us now by telephone from her home in Jackson, Wyoming. Pam, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
How do you prepare for an ultramarathon like Badwater? I mean, to run through those harsh conditions, how do you prepare yourself for that?
You know, I've done it for so many years that I have. First of all, I've lived in Tucson since I was 20, and I'm 45, so 25 years of acclimation there, I really believe has really helped me, number one. Number two, I love running when it's hot out. My body, for some reason, it works much better. You know, my muscles aren't as sore. I can take in more fluids because I guess I sweat them out quicker. I'm just, number one, I'm lucky for that. But what I've done, I started doing this a long time ago, and it was before Badwater, and it was mostly because of my lifestyle, because I have children, that I would run, you know, 2 to 3 times a day, and I would be able to break it up for a couple reasons. Number one, I haven't been injured because of that, but also because my children had to go to school or they had some sporting event or whatever it is. So that's how I've worked it around, and I've just continued that. And lately, you know, since I've gotten more into the more distance, I run maybe 4 times a day, but again, my lifestyle is, I'm lucky enough to be able to do that.
Well, you mentioned your children. You have 3 sons and then 2 stepchildren.
Correct.
How do you find that balance between your career and family?
Well, you know, every day is a total, it's a challenge to balance it, because sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. You know, so every day I have to do, you know, I have to pull in and try to check and see if I'm doing one thing too much. And so everybody does definitely pay a price. And I've been, again, lucky enough to be able to take my children with, and they've been able to experience some of my travels. But it's a constant, ongoing challenge.
Well, in the book, you write about your 15-year battle with anorexia. How did you overcome that disease, and how did it affect your running?
That's probably going to be like a really controversial thing that people will say. You know, they'll think that my running is part of my anorexia, and I would say never. It's interesting, but from the very beginning of that, I remember the exact day that I started being anorexic, and it was, I was a gymnast in high school, and I just wanted to look like Olga Corbett, who was this, like, she was 4'10", you know, I'm 5'3", and I wanted to beat her. So I just decided, you know, and this was, it just automatically came to my head that I was just going to stop eating. It had nothing to do with exercising, per se, to get there. It just had, I'm just going to stop eating. I don't remember reading anything about it or, you know, anything. I just decided I'd stop eating. And that's when I stopped, and how I overcame, which, you know, it's kind of always part of you, but definitely I would say, you know, almost 100% cured. But I actually put myself in hospitals twice, because at that point it was serious enough that I couldn't even drink water. And I was still, you know, running, doing my life. I mean, I had children, and it wasn't like I ever stopped. But I knew that I had to do something, and so I ended up going into a hospital. And the first time, I went for a month, and it just didn't work at all. I kind of just kept doing my same old, same old. And then the last time I was in, I looked around at all the people in there, and I just decided that I wasn't that sick. And I just said to myself, you know, I'm never going to be here again. I'm never going to let myself get to this point. So I've learned that food is fuel, as opposed to, I guess what I used to think is it was an enemy or it was going to do something bad. And, you know, the most ironic thing that I think as an athlete is, and I know there's a lot of athletes that have these problems with food, is it really is your best friend. You have to, you got to do it, or you're going to be you're going to run into major problems.
You've run the Badwater twice, and of course you've won twice. When you're running that 135-mile race, how do you maintain yourself in the harsh conditions? How do you, I mean, I would imagine that, I mean, to people who don't run every day, that it's an absolute grueling experience.
Well, exactly. Well, the way I approach most of these things is I'm kind of nonchalant about it. I try not to make a big deal about it because, in my opinion, you know, if you really thought about what we're going to entail in Badwater or in a 100-mile run, it's pretty daunting. You know, it's so mind-boggling. It's impossible in your brain. So I don't think of it like that. And what Badwater in particular is so much different than other events because we have people with you the entire time. I have vans and there's complete rules that you have to go by, but they can get out of the van and spray you down, and then they can get back in the van, and the van is air-conditioned. I will also have some people run along with me and they'll take turns maybe 15 minutes at a time so they don't get overheated. So they help me, and they'll hand me drinks and cool me off, and ice and different things like that. I put ice in my hat, ice around my neck. You know, they spray me down. Your legs, in particular, your legs tend to get extremely hot. And I noticed in your intro you had said the temperatures get over 120. Well, both years that I won, the first year it was 128, and the second year it was 130, and those were records. And I think that's partially why I did so well, because being, you know, 100 pounds and small, and being a woman, it clicked better where last year the temperature was 118 and really, you know, much more doable. So I think like a man who can definitely run faster than women, can go out and sustain the speed when it's not exactly that hot. So we'll see if it needs to be really hot.
The book is The Extra Mile, One Woman's Personal Journey to Ultra Running Greatness. Pam Reed, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Pam Reed is also the director of the Tucson Marathon, which will take place on December 10th. To find out more information on that race, log on to TucsonMarathon.com. The history of the Chinese in Tucson goes back to the 1880s, when they came here to work on the railroad. Last year, the Chinese community in Tucson had a grand opening of the cultural center in an effort to celebrate their heritage and culture. Su Yun Lee reports.
Ready? Begin.
Retired engineer Gary Lo, along with 30 other Chinese senior citizens, are practicing Qigong, a Chinese exercise similar to Tai Chi. After they're done exercising, everyone gathers around to play mahjong. In the meantime, steamed ribs and bok choy are being prepared in the kitchen. While you may think this is a scene from San Francisco's Chinatown, it's actually taking place right here in Tucson, at the Tucson Chinese Cultural Center located on River Road.
This building is about 13,000 square feet. We've got quite a few classrooms, and we have a nice basketball court back there, so we have outdoor activities for the kids.
Kenan Ji, president of the Tucson Chinese Association, says the cultural center was long overdue.
We have about 3,500 Chinese here in Tucson. It continues to grow. Since many years ago, Tucson Chinese Association decided that this is an important part of Tucson where we can continue our culture and our heritage and pass that on to our kids. And it was important that we had something like this for Tucson.
We try to cater to both ends of your age group.
Retired teacher Patsy Lee volunteers her time as program coordinator.
I run the seniors program, which we do on Thursdays, And we're right now starting what we call Fabulous Fridays, where we're trying to get to the younger parts of our community. So we have a Chinese school on Sundays. We have from, you know, video games to fun things. Like this Friday, we're going to have a ballroom dancing.
The architectural design of the center draws from both Western and Eastern influences. Donations from locals paid for the entire center. Again, Ken Nanji.
It was decided back in 1996 that we really need a new facility to carry on our heritage and our culture. And given that, we were scouting for a site, and we were lucky enough and fortunate enough to have a gentleman named Larry Leong and his partners to donate this land. We all talked about how we all came from China on a boat, and how we can kind of establish ourselves here in Tucson. Given that, the architect kind of drew a story to this building, and many individuals actually stepped up in the community and helped fund this building. When we finished the building and had our grand opening, we had a family named Jai Kai family and Herb Kai donate $1 million to this building. So that helped us really carry on this our mission and vision.
85-year-old Tucson native Mary Wong.
My family came here in 1881. Then my father came, and my father went back to China and bought my mother. Six of us were born in Tucson. So I know most of the Chinese people here, all the older Chinese people. Some of the new people I have met, but I didn't get to see them. And so this way we're learning to get together and play. We should have had this a long time ago, but we waited a long time.
Also a Tucson native, Patsy Lee says the center is where the past meets the future.
You know, most Asian cultures, it's always, you listen to your grandparents, you hear these stories. And what we want, like I said, if I can get the seniors to keep talking, and I'm gonna bring the younger generation, they'll look at them, and they'll hear these old stories about the horse and buggy. Because, you know, the younger generation goes, no way, you grew up in Tucson with horse and buggy. They didn't have cars, you know. So to me, just to have the past to meet the future is just, you know, like I said, brings tears to my eyes. And that's one of the important things for me. It's just to keep the cycle going. It's important to keep our culture.
Okay. He win, we lost.
The Tucson Chinese Cultural Center is open to everyone. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Suyan Lee.
And now here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
Tonight, starting at 7, Mystery Tour and DJ Bank provide the music for the all-you-can-eat dance buffet party. It's the return of the Bohemian Boogie at Zuzi's Theater, 738 North 5th Avenue. Oscar and Felix, a new look at The Odd Couple, has another weekend at the Top Hat Theater Club. Hot Love, a musical produced by Lisa Otey and her friends, runs at the Temple of Music and Art for one more weekend. And starting on Saturday, See How They Run, a Philip King play produced by the Live Theater Workshop. This is Mark McLemore for Arizona Spotlight.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Burock.